Hey, amigos, you know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Please help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. And if you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in, give me a thumb. Say hello while you're at it. It helps me a ton with the algorithm. And besides, it's real nice to see you there. And now, on to the show. Welcome, friend. Happy St. Nicholas Day from Casa de Blood. If you happen to be at the mall and you see the drunk guy in the Santa suit taking pictures, that's him. Wish him a happy holiday. Nah, no pictures with Santa this year, Chester. Well, first of all, it's a total ripoff. Second, you scared the shit out of him last year. So let's head in, friend. It's time to celebrate with some scary stories. Alright, that's better. Friends, I've got some big and very exciting news for y'all. Mine and Jeff's new book, The Splittail Files, is out on paperback. We decided it was time to put that tomfoolery in print, and y'all are gonna love it. It includes all the Splittail stories you've heard on the show, and the first few older stories have been redone in first person the way the later stories are. Buying a copy supports Jeff and I both, and everyone who writes a nice review for us will be shouted out right here on the show. Just pop the Splittail Files in the search menu. It's the first thing that comes up. Real easy to find. Oh, you're gonna love this. The center of the book is a two-page map of Splittail County, and it includes all the famous locations in the stories. It's actually kind of funny. Really, I think you guys are gonna love this. Also, there's artwork throughout the book for every story. So don't be a cheapskate. Help keep Jeff in his liquor and me in cigarettes. The Splittail Files. Get your copy today on Amazon.com. That is all. Anyway, tonight we've got a couple stories from the boss, Craig Groshek. In this first one, a man finds a strange phrase written on the bathroom wall and begins to notice a pattern. So, without further delay, from author Craig Groshek, I give you People Knob. The dive bar bathroom smelled like a mix of beer-soaked wood and overused cleaning chemicals that couldn't quite mask the underlying stench. I leaned against the chip sink, scrolling through my phone, killing time while waiting for my turn to use the stall. And that's when I noticed it. It was scratched into the wall beside the mirror in jagged, uneven letters. People Knob, followed by a phone number. The handwriting was chaotic, like it had been carved in a hurry, but the words were oddly precise. I chuckled under my breath. Drunken graffiti was a staple of places like this, but this one had a strange charm. I snapped a picture of it and sent it to a group chat I had with my friends, captioning it, "Found some quality poetry tonight." The replies were instant. "What does it even mean? Drunk people are wild. Bet it's a sex line. Call it, Peter." I laughed and tucked my phone back in my pocket. Yeah, no thanks. I had no interest in whatever prank or scam waited on the other end of that number. It was probably a hotline for weirdos who got off on creeping out random people. When I finally got home later that night, I looked at the picture again. People Knob. What a bizarre phrase. Who even thinks to write something like that? A week later, I saw it again. This time, it was at a trendy cafe downtown. I was washing my hands in their sleek, modern bathroom, the kind with motion sensor everything, when I spotted it etched faintly into the metal edge of the paper towel dispenser, the same sloppy handwriting and the same phone number. I froze, staring at it. The deja vu hit me hard. My brain tried to rationalize it. Maybe the same prankster had been here. Maybe it was some urban scavenger hunt or guerrilla marketing campaign. But why People Knob? It wasn't clever or catchy. It was just weird. I shook it off and returned to my table, but the encounter stuck with me. Over the next week, I saw the phrase in more places. A park bench near my office, a bus stop on my commute, once even scratched faintly into the wood of a restaurant booth where I was having dinner with coworkers. The graffiti definitely wasn't confined to seedy places, and it was spreading. At first, I ignored it. That is, until I started to feel like it was following me. 2 weeks after my first encounter, I decided to give in to curiosity. I was at home scrolling through my photos when I came across the picture I had taken in the dive bar. My thumb hovered over the phone number. Rationally, I knew better. Calling random numbers scrawled on bathroom walls wasn't something normal people did. But the sheer repetition of it had me on edge. What was it? A joke? A secret? Or something else entirely? I reasoned with myself that it was probably some bored teenager having fun. I'd call, laugh at the nonsense, and put this whole thing to rest. Before I could second guess myself, I hit the call button. The line connected, but no one spoke. For a moment, there was nothing but silence. Then there were sounds. Sloshing, gurgling, wet, visceral noises that made my skin crawl. I blinked, confused. Was it a bad connection? Some kind of strange audio file? I'd hardly had time to consider all the possibilities when faintly, in the background, I heard what sounded like muffled screaming. My stomach turned. I gripped the phone tighter, trying to make sense of what I was hearing. The sounds weren't static. They were deliberate and organic. Whatever was happening on the other end of the line was deeply wrong and sounded very, very real. "Hello?" I said, my voice cracking slightly. No answer, just the wet, squelching noises and tortured screams. I hung up, my heart racing. For a few minutes, I just sat there staring at my phone, trying to process what had just happened. Maybe it was a prank, some kind of sick joke. But the screams, they sounded genuine. I tried not to think about it. I shoved my phone into my pocket, turned on the TV, and drowned the memory in sitcom reruns. I barely had time to relax when the phone buzzed, and I nearly jumped out of my skin. I peered down at my screen and swallowed hard. I gasped when I realized it was the same number, the one I had just called, and it was calling me back. Against my better judgment, I answered, my hands trembling slightly. The same noises poured into my ear, slurping and squelching, and now a bizarre mechanical whirring. It sounded something like a grinder or a machine chewing through something. Beyond the din, I heard more screaming, this time louder and more desperate.
"Who is this?"
I shouted, panic overtaking me. I received no response, but it was clear now that someone on the other line was listening. I could hear them breathing, heavy, labored inhalations that filled the silence between the grotesque sounds. I couldn't take it anymore.
"I'm calling the police, you sick freak!"
I yelled, smashing the end call button. I blocked the number and tossed the phone onto the couch. That night, for the first time in years, I double-checked that all my doors and windows were locked. I didn't sleep. Even after making sure that the locks on my doors and windows were functional, I didn't feel safe. Instead, I felt like I was being watched. I had no reason to believe that the owner of the number knew where I lived, and yet, I couldn't relax. The call had rattled me more than I wanted to admit. Those sounds, wet, organic, and punctuated by screaming, played on repeat in my mind. I told myself again it was a harmless prank meant to freak me out, but my gut told me otherwise. The next morning, still groggy from the lack of sleep, I decided to report the calls. It felt ridiculous walking into the police station to explain what had happened, but it seemed like the right thing to do under the circumstances. I'd spent the drive there rehearsing what I'd say, trying to make it sound as normal as possible. The desk officer looked unimpressed as I laid it all out.
You called a number scratched on a bathroom wall, and they made noises at you?
He quirked an eyebrow. I cleared my throat.
It wasn't just noises. It sounded like someone was screaming, and there was this machine sound. It wasn't normal.
The officer leaned back in his chair, stifling a yawn.
Look, unless they threatened you or you've got proof of a crime, there's not much we can do. Probably just some pervert having a laugh. Block the number and move on.
I felt a spark of irritation flare.
So if this person is hurting someone, like the screaming I heard, you're just going to ignore it?
He gave me a look that said he was done humoring me.
We get weird calls reported all the time. If it happens again, record it and bring that in. But for now, I suggest you let it go.
I walked out of the station fuming. Let it go? Sure, I'd just forget the horrifying sounds and the way my stomach dropped when the number called back. The cops clearly weren't going to help. That night, my friends and I decided to hit up a new bar downtown. I figured a few drinks and some good company would be enough to distract me from the unsettling events of the past few days. By the time we arrived, I was already a couple of beers in, feeling the edge of my anxiety dull. The place was crowded and lively, with dim lighting and music loud enough to vibrate the walls. My friends and I grabbed a corner booth, ordering drinks and shouting over the noise to catch up on everyone's week.
Still freaked out about that creepy phone call?
My friend Kyle asked. I shrugged, not wanting to get into it.
Block the number. Haven't heard anything since.
See?
He said with a grin.
Problem solved. You just gotta quit being such a magnet for weird stuff.
I forced a laugh, but my unease lingered. After a while, the drinks caught up to me and I excused myself to find the bathroom. The hallway leading there was narrow and lined with framed vintage posters. The bathroom itself was what you'd expect. Grimy tile, flickering fluorescent lights, and a stall door that didn't quite close all the way. I stepped into the stall and sighed, leaning against the wall as I did my business. That's when I heard it. Someone entered the stall next to mine, their footsteps heavy. There was something unusual about the way they moved, accompanied by a dragging sound that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Then came the noises. Wet, slurping sounds like someone sucking the marrow from a bone. My chest tightened as I recognized the sounds from the phone calls. What were the odds? I froze, straining to hear. I had to be sure. As I listened, the noises grew louder and more grotesque. A faint rhythmic gulping, like something viscous being stirred and then swallowed. I couldn't breathe. My mind raced with panic, screaming at me to get out. I zipped up and stumbled out of the stall, barely registering the flickering lights overhead. I burst back into the main bar area, overwhelmed by the urge to flee the building. I didn't care if I sounded insane.
Guys,
I said, grabbing Kyle's arm.
Someone's in the bathroom. It's the same thing from the calls.
My friends exchanged glances, clearly skeptical.
What are you talking about?
Kyle asked, frowning.
I'm not joking. Just come look.
They followed me, laughing nervously as we made our way back to the bathroom. I pushed open the door, fully expecting to see someone or something waiting inside. It was empty. The bathroom was empty. There were no dragging footsteps and no wet noises. Just a faint hum of flickering fluorescent lights, and me looking like an absolute fool. My friends groaned in frustration.
"Dude, you've had way too much to drink,"
Kyle said, shaking his head.
"Wait,"
I said, pointing to the stall I'd been in. The words "people knob" were freshly etched into the metal door, the jagged letters standing out starkly against the smoothly polished surface.
"What the hell?"
one of my friends muttered, leaning in for a closer look. Kyle snorted.
"So someone's been tagging bathrooms. Big deal."
"It wasn't here when I walked in,"
I snapped, my voice rising.
"I swear to God, something's going on."
Kyle rolled his eyes.
"Fine. Let's see how funny this pervert thinks they are."
He whipped out his phone and dialed the number before I could stop him.
"No! What are you doing, Kyle?"
I shouted.
"Are you crazy?"
I grabbed for his phone, but he held it out of reach.
"You don't get it. Now they'll have your number too."
Kyle laughed.
"Relax, man. They're probably some loser living in their mom's basement. I'll give them a piece of my mind."
He held the phone to his ear. A moment later, we heard the line connect, and then his grin faded. His expression shifted from amused to confused, then to something else entirely. Fear.
"What is it, Kyle?"
I asked, dread pulling in my stomach. His voice was barely a whisper.
They want to talk to you, Peter."
I didn't speak to Kyle for the rest of the night. I barely even said goodbye to my friends as I bolted out of the bar. The words, "they want to talk to you," played on a loop in my head, growing louder with each repetition until I felt like my skull would split. The streets blurred past me as I power walked toward home, sweat slicking my palms. The city lights offered no comfort. Each shadow, every passing stranger, felt sinister. When I reached my apartment building, I froze at the sight of my door. It was ajar. I stood there for a moment, rooted in place. Had I forgotten to lock it? No, I remembered doing it before I left. My gut twisted as I opened the door, wincing at the creak of the hinges. The living room looked normal, too normal. My laptop was still on the coffee table, the half-empty bag of chips from earlier in the day untouched. Nothing seemed out of place, and yet the air felt heavy. Grabbing the largest kitchen knife I owned, I began a slow, deliberate sweep of the apartment. My breath caught in my throat as I checked the closets, under the bed, and behind the shower curtain. Everything was as it should be. Everything, that is, except the bathroom. When I turned the light on, I nearly dropped the knife. There it was, "people knob," scratched into the tile above the sink. The same message that had haunted me for days. The jagged letters glared back at me, meticulously scrawled in identical handwriting. I stumbled back. This wasn't just a prank. Someone had been in my apartment. Someone who knew exactly what they were doing. I didn't waste another second. I bolted out of the building, knife still in hand, and called my best friend Jake, begging to crash on his couch for the night. Jake didn't ask many questions. He'd always been the kind of guy who didn't pry, which was one of the reasons I trusted him. I gave him the short version. Someone had broken into my apartment and left a creepy message. He nodded grimly, offering me a blanket and a beer. The next morning, after calling my landlord and leaving them a voicemail explaining why I was leaving, I packed a bag and drove to my parents' house. I couldn't face going back to the apartment, not yet. My mom fussed over me the way she always did, offering coffee and concerned questions. My dad was quieter, his frown deep and contemplative as I explained the situation.
"This some kind of stalker, you think?"
he asked finally.
"I don't know," I replied.
The police didn't take it seriously the first time, and now... I trailed off, unsure of how to explain the gravity of what had happened. My parents did their best to make me feel secure. For the first time in days, I felt like I could breathe again. The isolation of the house, the way it sat back from the road surrounded by tall trees, felt like a buffer between me and whatever was happening. By the second night, I even managed to sleep. The illusion of safety didn't last. It was my mom's cell phone that rang first. We were sitting in the kitchen sipping coffee and talking about mundane things when she picked it up. Her face clouded with confusion as she looked at the screen.
"It's for you,"
she said, holding the phone out to me. I stared at her, my blood turning to ice.
"What do you mean it's for me?"
"I don't know,"
she said, frowning.
"I just feel like it's meant for you."
My hands shook as I took the phone from her.
"Hello?"
The line was silent for a moment. Then the familiar noises began. Slurping, squelching, and the faint hum of a machine grinding in the background. Farther back, quiet but still audible, were the muffled screams. I hung up immediately, my chest heaving. The phone dropped from my hand onto the kitchen table.
"What is it?"
my mom asked, alarmed.
"It's them," I whispered. They followed me here."
After that, I knew I couldn't stay at my parents' house any longer. Whatever this was, it wasn't going to stop. It didn't matter where I went, and the last thing I wanted was for my parents to get involved, or worse, hurt. My landlord called me back the next day, promising to change the locks and install security cameras. The police assured me they'd patrol the area. Reluctantly, I agreed to return to the apartment. When I arrived, the building seemed quieter than usual. My neighbors' doors were all shut tight, and the hallways were silent except for the faint hum of the overhead lights. I unlocked the door, half expecting the graffiti to still be on the bathroom wall, but everything looked pristine. The landlord had done a thorough job cleaning up. I spotted several new cameras on the way in. Everything looked good so far. I let out a shaky breath and dropped my bag onto the couch. For the first time in days, I felt a sliver of hope. Maybe it was over. Maybe I could start piecing my life back together. Then I noticed a voicemail notification on my phone. It was from my landlord, time-stamped about 30 minutes before I arrived. Somehow I had missed it. I pressed play, holding the phone to my ear.
"Peter, it's Jim,"
the message began, his voice trembling.
"Listen, I was reviewing the security footage from the night of the break-in, and look, I don't know how to say this, but whatever went into your apartment that night, it never left. It's still in there. I'm on my way with the police. Don't go inside. Whatever you do, don't..."
The message cut off. I stood there, frozen. Jim's message hadn't even had time to register yet by the time a sound reached me from the bedroom. It was faint at first, but as I listened, it grew louder. A wet, scraping noise, punctuated by the rhythmic thud of heavy footsteps. They were getting closer. I didn't even grab my bag. I bolted out the door and sprinted down the street. I didn't stop running until I was blocks away and my legs gave out. My lungs felt as if they were on fire by the time I collapsed on a bench near a 24-hour diner. I gulped down air, glancing over my shoulder like a hunted animal. Every shadow on the sidewalk, every car passing by, felt like a threat. Jim's voicemail replayed in my mind, his panicked words echoing over the sound of those dragging footsteps. Whatever went into my apartment that night, it never left. I never went back to my apartment again. By the time my landlord and the police arrived, I was already gone, sitting in Jake's living room, shaking as I tried to explain what had happened. Jake didn't interrupt, and for once, he didn't even crack a joke. When I finished, he sat in stunned silence.
"Man, you're not going back there, are you?"
he finally asked. I shook my head vehemently.
"No, I'm done. I'm not going back. Not when it knows where I live."
And I meant it. Whatever I left behind, clothes, furniture, even my laptop, it wasn't worth my trouble or my life. Jake offered to let me crash at his place for a while, but I knew that wasn't an option. I didn't want whatever it was to follow me there, too. I spent the next week at a cheap motel on the edge of town, paying in cash and keeping my phone turned off except to check for updates from the landlord and the cops. Each night, I triple-checked the locks on the door and windows, slept with the lights on, and tucked a knife under my pillow. The landlord called twice. The first time, he left a voicemail saying the apartment was empty when they arrived. According to him, there was no sign of forced entry, no signs of anyone or anything inside. I couldn't help but scoff. The second time, he didn't leave a message. I left town the following weekend. I packed what little I could fit into my car and drove until the city was a distant memory. I settled in a small town a few states away, a quiet place where nobody knew my name. I found a job at a local hardware store and rented a modest room from an elderly couple's garage. For a while, I began to believe I could move on. Unfortunately, as it turns out, the damage was already done. I still see it sometimes. Not the thing itself, thank God, but the aftermath. Little signs that remind me that it's still out there. A phrase scrawled on the wall in a familiar handwriting. A phone number scratched into the edge of a table at a diner. Once I swore I caught a glimpse of the words "people knob" on a sticky note stuck to the inside of a bus shelter. I never take the bus anymore. Perhaps I'm just lucky, but the calls have stopped. I changed my number, disconnected my old phone, and started over with a new device. And so far, I've managed to avoid any strange voicemails or late-night calls. The fear, however, still lingers. The nightmares are the worst. In them, I'm back at my old apartment. The walls are covered in the words "people knob," carved so deeply that the plaster is flaking off. Wet gurgling sounds fill the air, punctuated by agonized screams that seem to come from everywhere and nowhere at once. In the dream, I know I should run, but my legs refuse to move. Something approaches me, its footsteps slow and deliberate, dragging heavily across the floor. I always wake up before I see it. I don't talk about it much anymore. Jake's the only person who even knows the full story, and even he avoids bringing it up. It's easier that way, pretending like it never happened. But sometimes, when I see a jagged handwriting etched into a random bathroom stall or a graffiti-covered wall, I wonder how many other people have called the number. That number. And I wonder how many others got out alive.
Love horror stories. Well, I've got plenty to share. I'm Otis Gyre, your host, for Otis Gyre's Nightmare Fuel, where every week I spin spine-chilling tales that'll have you sleeping with the lights on. Picture this. A crackling campfire, the dark woods of Camp Duskwood, and Twilight Lake whispering in the distance. That's where I invite campers, just like you, to join me around the fire as I share stories of haunted highways, cursed deals, and things lurking just out of sight. If you're a fan of Drew Blood's dark tales, you'll feel right at home by my fire, so pull up a seat. The stories are dark, fire's warm, and there's always room for one more camper. Just don't wander too far into the woods. You never know what's watching. Otis Jarvie's Nightmare Fuel has just debuted, and I've got spine-tingling episodes waiting for you to binge right now. New campers, join me every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for Fresh Tales of Terror. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find quality podcasts. Join the campfire, if you dare.
And that was People Knob by Craig Groshek. A good reminder not to call those numbers you find carved in the bathroom stalls. These aren't women you want to bring home to meet your mother. Almost as bad as bringing a knob home to meet your dad. Anyway, we've got another one for you. In this one, we learn about a mysterious room at school where the naughty kids get sent. So again, from Craig Groshek, I give you The Goodness Room. I've never talked about this before. I'm not even sure why I'm posting it now, except that it's been eating at me for years. Maybe someone here will believe me, or maybe I just need to get it out. Either way, this is the truth, as much as I can make sense of it. When I was 7, my mom died. It was sudden, an aneurysm. She collapsed in the middle of the kitchen, and by the time the ambulance arrived, she was gone. My dad didn't know what to do. He was this big, quiet guy who'd worked the same warehouse job for years, and after Mom died, he just froze. A few months later, he'd packed up my little brother Dallas and me and moved us to a mining town in West Virginia. He'd gotten a new job, something that kept him away for long hours and left him too tired to talk most nights. The town was tiny, just a cluster of houses, a single gas station, and this old K-12 school that looked like it hadn't been updated since the 1950s. It smelled like mildew and old chalkboards, and the floor creaked with every step. There were only 2 teachers for my grade, and they were so strict that I'd nearly have a panic attack if they so much as looked disappointed in me. The rules were everything at that school. If you didn't follow them, you were warned. If the initial warnings didn't work, you'd hear the same threat. Don't make me send you to the goodness room. At first, I thought it was just a story, something to scare us into behaving, like the boogeyman. The other kids acted like it was no big deal, even laughing about it sometimes. The goodness room's just a janitor's closet, one kid said. Another whispered it was where they made kids sit in the dark until they cried. No one really knew, and none of us were brave enough to find out. Then Jacob got sent there. Jacob was this wiry, loudmouthed kid who was always getting into trouble. He'd steal pencils off desks, shout dumb jokes during class, and talk back to teachers like he didn't care what happened to him. I think we all secretly admired him for that, but one day he went too far. It was during math. Mrs. Granger, our teacher, was already annoyed with Jacob for humming loudly while she was explaining long division. Then he made some smart remark about her old lady perfume, and she snapped.
"That's it,"
she said, her voice sharp enough to cut glass.
"Jacob, you're going to the goodness room."
He froze, and for the first time, I saw fear flicker in his face.
"What? No, I'll stop."
two men appeared at the door dressed in suits that didn't match the peeling walls of the classroom. Without a word, they walked in, grabbed Jacob by the arms, and dragged him out. He screamed, kicking and thrashing, but they didn't flinch. The door slammed shut behind them, and the room went dead silent. None of us said a word for the rest of the day. Jacob didn't come back to class the next day, or the day after that. The first day, we all just assumed he had been suspended. He was always in trouble, and a couple of days at home didn't seem out of the ordinary. But by the third day, kids started whispering. "What if he's still in the goodness room?" one girl asked during lunch, her voice barely audible over the clatter of trays.
"No way,"
a boy replied, his tone dismissive.
"They're not allowed to keep you there that long. My cousin got sent once, and he was back in class the same day."
"What happened to him?"
I asked, but the boy just shrugged. The whispers stopped when Jacob finally walked back into class on Friday. At first, we were relieved. He wasn't hurt or crying, but then we got a better look at him. Jacob wasn't the same. He didn't crack jokes or smile like he used to. His face was blank, his eyes dull, like all the light had been sucked out of him. He didn't even flinch when Mrs. Granger barked at him to sit down. When recess came, the usual chaos of kids running around the playground didn't touch him. He just sat on the bench, staring straight ahead. A couple of us gathered around him, trying to figure out what had happened.
"Where were you?"
one of the girls asked. Jacob's eyes flickered toward her for a second before he muttered,
"I was in the goodness room."
His voice was flat, mechanical.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
I asked. He didn't answer. Instead, he pulled the collar of his shirt higher up his neck, like he was trying to hide something. But we had already seen it, a small black number printed on the back of his neck.
"What's that?"
another boy asked, pointing. Jacob's hand shot up to cover the tattoo.
"Nothing,"
he mumbled.
"Did they do that to you in the goodness room?"
I pressed. Jacob froze for a moment, then nodded ever so slightly.
"I'm not supposed to talk about it,"
he whispered.
"Not about the room. Not about my assignment."
"Assignment?"
I repeated, confused. He didn't elaborate. Instead, he stood up abruptly and walked back toward the school building. That night, I told my dad everything. We were sitting at the kitchen table. Dallas was upstairs in bed, and the only sound was the hum of the refrigerator. I told him about the goodness room, about Jacob and the tattoo. My dad sighed and rubbed his face. He looked so tired.
"It's probably just some disciplinary thing, Emmett,"
he said.
"Some schools do that. Scare the kids a little so they straighten up."
"But, Dad..."
"Look, I know you're upset, but I need you to focus on yourself, okay? Don't get in trouble, and you won't have to worry about any of this."
I wanted to argue, to make him understand how wrong it all felt, but I could tell he wasn't really listening. His job at the mine was hard, and I knew he was doing his best just to keep us afloat, so I dropped it. But I couldn't stop thinking about Jacob and his tattoo. In the days that followed, I watched him closely. He never spoke unless a teacher called on him, and even then his answers were short and robotic. He never played during recess, never smiled, never laughed. It was like someone had flipped a switch in his head and turned off everything that made him unique, that made him Jacob. The worst part was the way the teachers treated him. They didn't scold him or even look annoyed anymore. It was like he had become their perfect student, the kind they had always wanted. The other kids started avoiding him. At first, I thought it was because they didn't want to be around someone so strange. but I realized it was more than that. They were scared. And honestly, so was I. For a little while, things at school went back to normal. Well, as normal as they could get under the circumstances. I kept my head down, stuck to the rules, and tried not to think about the goodness room. But then, it happened to Dallas. It started during art. Dallas was in second grade and his class had been painting something for Thanksgiving. Turkeys, I think. He was always kind of clumsy, and when he got excited, his arms flailed like crazy. One wrong move and he knocked over a jar of red paint, spilling it all over another kid's project. The teacher, Mrs. Kirkland, lost it. She yelled at Dallas, called him careless, and told him to clean it up. I wasn't there to see it, but one of his classmates told me later that Dallas started crying, apologizing over and over. That didn't stop her. By the end of the day, I was waiting for Dallas at the bus stop like usual, but he didn't show up. Dread welled up inside me as the bus came and went, leaving me standing there alone. Something terrible had happened. I knew it. I ran home as fast as I could, bursting through the door and shouting for Dad. He was already in the kitchen, his face pale and grim.
"Where's Dallas?"
I asked, breathless.
"He's still at school," Dad said quietly.
"Why?"
Dad hesitated.
"The teacher called me. Said he got sent to some room. The goodness room." My eyes widened.
"Dad, you have to go get him."
"I tried," he said. "I called, but they said it was part of their disciplinary policy. Like after-school detention. They wouldn't let me pick him up early." Dallas didn't come home until after dinner. The instant he walked through the door, I knew something was wrong. His eyes were empty. His shoulders slumped, just like Jacob, and he didn't say a word. I ran up to hug him, but he stepped back, like he didn't even recognize me.
Dallas?
I whispered, my voice trembling. He didn't answer. Then I saw it, a small black number tattooed at the base of his neck, just like Jacob's.
"What did they do to you?"
I choked out. He glanced at me, his face blank, and said,
"I'm not supposed to talk about it."
Dad tried to get him to eat, to talk, to show some sign of his old self, but Dallas just sat there staring into space. Finally, Dad slammed his fist on the table and stood up.
"That's it," he said. "I'm going to the school."
I tried to stop him.
"Dad, they won't tell you anything. They'll just..."
"I don't care," he shouted, grabbing his coat. "They can't do this to my son."
He stormed out, leaving Dallas and me alone in the quiet, dimly lit kitchen. I wanted to cry, to scream, to do something, anything. But all I could do was sit there staring at my brother, who didn't even seem to realize I was in the room. Dad didn't come back until late that night. When he walked in, I could tell something had happened. His face was pale, his eyes unfocused. He looked like he had aged 10 years in just a few hours.
Dad?
I asked hesitantly. He didn't answer right away. He just stood there, swaying slightly, like he was trying to remember how to speak. Then he slowly rolled up the sleeve of his shirt. There, on his wrist, was a black tattoo. My blood ran cold.
"No,"
I whispered.
What did they do to you?"
He looked at me, and for a split second I thought I saw tears in his eyes. But then his expression shifted, smoothing out into something vacant and unfamiliar.
"You need to be a good boy, Emmett," he said, his voice low and hollow. "Do as you're told at school. Don't ask questions."
I shook my head back and away, struggling to hold back tears.
Dad, this isn't you. They did something to you, didn't they?
But he didn't respond. He just turned and walked into his bedroom, leaving me alone with Dallas. For the next few days, it was like living with strangers. Dallas and Dad went about their routines like nothing had happened. But neither of them smiled or laughed. They barely spoke to me unless it was to tell me to behave. I felt like I was losing my mind. Whatever the goodness room was, it wasn't just some disciplinary measure. It was changing people, taking something from them. And I knew it was only a matter of time before I was next, and I wasn't about to sit around and wait for it to happen. For the next few days, I made sure to stay out of trouble at school. I didn't speak unless spoken to. I avoided eye contact, but I was always watching, listening. The teachers seemed different now. They didn't raise their voices as often and didn't bother with the usual lectures or detentions. The threat of the goodness room was all they needed. If a kid even looked like they might act out, the teacher would pause, fix them with a cold stare, and say, "Do you want to visit the goodness room?" No one argued anymore. At home, things had gotten worse. Dad barely spoke to me, and when he did, it was only to remind me to be good. Dallas remained quiet and distant, like a dog going through the motions of being alive. Every time I saw that tattoo on the back of his neck, I felt sick to my stomach. Before long, I couldn't take it anymore. I had to know what was happening. One night, after everyone else had gone to bed, I made up my mind to take matters into my own hands. I packed a flashlight, a screwdriver, and a pocket knife into my school backpack. It wasn't much, but it was all I had. I slipped out of the back door and made my way to the school. The air was cold and sharp, the only sounds the crunch of my sneakers on the gravel road and the occasional rustle of leaves on the wind. The school looked even more ominous at night. The windows were dark, and the peeling paint on the walls seemed to glow faintly in the moonlight. I hesitated at the entrance, my hand hovering over the doorknob, before finally pushing it open. The hallways were silent, the fluorescent lights flickering faintly overhead. I kept my footsteps light, moving toward the back of the school where I'd seen Jacob taken that day. Eventually, I found it, a heavy metal door at the end of a dim hallway. There was no label on it, just a small keypad. The goodness room. I had no idea what the code was, but I tried the handle anyway. Locked. I crouched down and used a screwdriver to pry open the panel on the side of the keypad. Inside was a mess of wires, and I had no idea what I was doing, but I was prepared to break the door down if I needed to. Fortunately, it didn't come to that. After a few minutes of fumbling with the wires, the lock gave a soft click, and the door creaked open. The smell hit me immediately. The scent of antiseptic and iron, like blood. I shined my flashlight into the room, and my breath hitched. Whatever the place was, it sure as hell wasn't a janitor's closet. The room was cramped and sterile, with stark white walls. In the center, a single metal chair was bolted to the floor, straps hanging loosely from the arm and footrests. Above it, there was a mechanical arm tipped with a needle-like tool. Nearby, a table held a variety of surgical instruments I didn't recognize. On the far wall, a monitor displayed a list of names and numbers, many of them crossed out. I saw Jacob's name there, Dallas's too. I felt like I was going to throw up.
"What are you doing here?"
The voice startled me so badly that I almost dropped my flashlight. I turned to see one of the teachers, Mr. Keller, standing in the doorway. His face was partially obscured by shadows, but I could see the anger in his eyes.
I just wanted to see,
I stammered.
You shouldn't have come here,
he said, stepping into the room. Behind him, two men in suits appeared. Before I could run, they grabbed me, dragging me toward the chair. I screamed and kicked, but they were too strong. They strapped me in, tightening the restraints around my wrists and ankles until I couldn't move. The needle on the mechanical arm began to glow faintly, and the arm moved toward me.
No!
I yelled, struggling against the straps.
Let me go!
But they didn't listen. One of the men pressed a button and the needle lowered toward the base of my neck. I felt a sharp sting, like the prick of a bee, and then the strap on my right wrist snapped. I didn't think, I acted. I yanked my arm free and grabbed the needle, pulling it away before it could go any deeper. One of the men lunged at me, but I swung the flashlight, hitting him square in the face, sending him reeling and clutching his nose. I freed my other hand and tore off the ankle straps, scrambling out of the chair as fast as possible. The men shouted, but I didn't stop. I ran past them out into the hallway and through the front doors. The cold air assaulted my senses, but I never stopped, not once. I didn't even look back. I ran until my legs burned and my lungs ached. Soon, school disappeared behind me, replaced by endless fields and dark woods. I kept going, driven by pure adrenaline and the thought that if I slowed down, they'd catch me. Eventually, headlights appeared in the distance. A car. No, a police cruiser. I stumbled into the road, waving my arms frantically. The cruiser slowed and the officer inside stepped out, shining a flashlight on me.
Kid, what the hell happened to you?
He asked. I tried to answer, but all I could do was gasp for air.
It's okay,
the officer said, guiding me into the car.
You're safe now.
But I didn't feel safe. Not yet. Not while the goodness room still existed. The officer drove me toward my house, and for the first time that night I allowed myself to believe I might be okay. The adrenaline was fading, and exhaustion was winning out. My head rested against the cool window as the cruiser rumbled over the gravel road. When we turned onto my street, though, my heart dropped. Red and orange flames lit up the sky above my house. No, I thought. It couldn't be. My house was on fire. Fire trucks were already there doing their best to quell the inferno. Smoke billowed into the air, and neighbors stood outside staring at the scene. The officer slammed on the brakes and bolted out of the car. I followed, my legs shaking as I stumbled toward the crowd.
No,
I whispered, the word catching in my throat. One of the firefighters tried to stop me.
Kid, stay back. You can't...
My family's in there,
I screamed, trying to push past him. He grabbed me, holding me back.
It's too late. We're still putting it out. But ain't no one coming out of that. I'm so sorry.
I stopped struggling, my knees buckling beneath me. The heat from the flames felt like it was crawling over my skin. Dallas.
Dad. Gone. Everybody gone.
I sat on the curb as the fire raged on. The officer tried to ask me questions. What had happened, where I'd been. But I couldn't speak. My throat was raw. My world shattered. I just stared at the house, the home I'd shared with my family, as it crumbled before my eyes. When the flames finally died down, they recovered two bodies. The coroner was thoughtful, wrapping them up gently. I didn't need to see them to know. My dad. My brother. Dead. The police later ruled it was an electrical fire, likely caused by faulty wiring. It was a tragic accident, the report said. But I knew better. I overheard one of the investigators say something about the bodies, how they were burned so badly that there was almost nothing left to identify them. Any trace of the tattoos they had had, the ones I'd seen myself, were gone, and along with them, any hope of proving what had happened to them. It felt deliberate. Someone wanted to erase my family, to make sure there was no evidence tying them and their death to the school, to the goodness room. The next few weeks were a blur. Social workers came and went, offering me condolences and promises they couldn't keep. I was sent to live with a foster family in another town, far away from the school. I tried to tell the police about the goodness room, about what the school was doing, but no one really believed me.
The goodness room?
One officer asked, raising an eyebrow.
Are you sure it wasn't just some detention program?
They tattooed them,
I insisted, my voice shaking.
They did something to them in there. Something awful. My dad. He wasn't the same anymore. Not after what they did to him.
But they just gave me those pitying looks, the kind adults give when they think a kid's struggling to cope with trauma. When it became clear I wasn't going to take no for an answer, they finally agreed to interview the school staff. They denied everything.
The goodness room isn't real,
the principal said, shaking her head.
It's like an urban legend, something the kids made up to scare each other.
The teachers backed her up. They claimed Jacob, Dallas, and I were troublemakers, prone to exaggerating. Speaking of Jacob, I tried to find his family, but they were gone. Moved away, according to the neighbors. No forwarding address, no phone number. It was like they'd vanished. I didn't know what to think anymore. Decades later, I still don't understand what happened. Was the goodness room some kind of experiment or a punishment? Or something worse? I'll never forget the look in my dad's eyes when he came home that night, or the way Dallas had been hollowed out, replaced by someone that looked an awful lot like my brother, but wasn't. I've kept quiet over the years, and I've put a lot of miles between myself and the school. Sometimes, though, I wonder if the teachers, the principal, and the men in suits are still out there, waiting to finish what they started. I worry that even after all this time, they're just waiting for me to slip up, to stop behaving myself, and that I'll wake up to find myself back in that room with a number on my neck. If you've ever been to a school like mine, or heard whispers from your neighbors, or, God forbid, your own children, about a place like the goodness room, please, I'm begging you, run. Get as far away as you can, and do it now, before it's too late. Because whatever it is, it doesn't just punish you. It takes something. And once it does, you never get it back.
And that was The Goodness Room by Craig Groshek. And here we were, worried about transgenders in the girls' room. A little about the author. Craig Groshek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, which has grown to nearly 500,000 subscribers, over 3,000 uploads, and more than 69 million video views in its 12 years of operation. He also oversees the production of 4 weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, faithfully adapting and featuring the work of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his short stories have been adapted to audio for the channel and other platforms. He holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Wisconsin. In his free time, Groshek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with his 3 horror-loving children and close friends.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So grab a drink for the road, friend. Might as well. You already smell like the mall Santa. So may the wind be at your back and may the road rise up to meet you. Call Craig for a good time. And of course, good night, y'all.